Sketch for an Historical Picture of the Advances of the Human Mind by Nicolas de Condorcet. 10th Era. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. 10th Era. Future Advances of the Human Mind. If man can predict with almost perfect certainty phenomena whose laws he knows, and if, even when he doesn't know those laws, experience of the past enables him to foresee future events with high probability, why would it be thought fanciful to try to draw a plausible picture of what lies in store for mankind on the strength of its past history? The sole basis for trust in the natural sciences is the thesis that the general laws governing the phenomena of the universe are necessary and constant. Whether or not we know them, why shouldn't this principle hold just as well for the development of man's intellectual and moral faculties as it does for the other operations of nature? Given that the wisest men are guided in their conduct solely by opinions based on past experience of similar situations, why shouldn't the philosopher be allowed that same basis to support his conjectures, as long as he doesn't claim for them more certainty than is warranted by the number, consistency, and precision of the relevant observations? Our hopes for the future state of mankind come down to 3 points. The first is the destruction of the inequality among nations. Aren't all nations bound some day to approach the state of civilization reached by the peoples who are most enlightened, most free, most clear of prejudices, such as the French and the Anglo-Americans? The chasm separating these peoples from the slavery of countries subjected to kings, from the barbarity of African tribes, and from the ignorance of savages, mustn't it gradually vanish? Or are there territories on the globe whose inhabitants are condemned by nature never to enjoy liberty, never to exercise their reason? The second point is advances in equality within individual nations. The difference in knowledge, means, and wealth that has so far been visible in all civilized nations between the different classes making up each nation, what is the status of this inequality that the earliest advances of society have increased? Is it integral to civilization as such? Or is it one of the imperfections of the social art? Is it on course to lessen continually, being replaced by the actual equality that lessens even the effects of the natural differences in people's abilities, leaving only such inequality as is useful to everyone, because it favours civilization, education, and industry, without creating dependence, humiliation, or poverty? Are men approaching a state in which folly and misery will be only occasional accidents, and not the permanent state of a considerable portion of society? The third point is the real improvement of mankind. Is the human race going to become better either through new discoveries in the sciences and the arts, resulting in improvements in individual well-being and general prosperity, or by making further advances in the principles of conduct and in moral practice, or by real improvement of our moral, intellectual, and physical abilities? In answering these 3 questions, we'll find the strongest reasons, from past experience, from observation of the advances that the sciences and civilization have made up to now, and from analyzing the journey of the human mind and the development of its abilities, to believe that nature has set no limits to what we can look forward to. Now down to details. The things I say here about the future will be shown to be true in the complete work of which the present one is a sketch. First, inequality among nations. If we take a quick look at the present state of the globe, we'll see right away that in Europe the principles of the French Constitution are already those of every enlightened man. We'll see them too widely disseminated there, and too openly professed, for tyrants and priests to block them from gradually penetrating the hovels of their slaves. And there they'll soon awaken the remnants of the slaves' good sense, and arouse in the soul of the oppressed the silent indignation that a life of humiliation and terror can't extinguish. Looking then at the different nations, we'll see what particular obstacles each of them poses to this revolution, and what particular factors favour it. We'll pick out those where it is on course to come about gently through the wisdom of their governments, and those that will be dragged into swift and terrible events because the revolution has been made violent by their government's resistance to it. Can it be doubted that either the good sense or the senseless rivalries of the European nations, cooperating with the slow but unstoppable effects of the advances of their colonies, will soon produce the independence of the New World, and that then the European population of those former colonies, rapidly spreading across that enormous territory, will either civilize the savage nations still occupying immense tracts of it, or peacefully cause them to disappear? Survey the history of our enterprises and establishments in Africa or in Asia, and you'll see our trade monopolies, our treachery, our blood-soaked contempt for men of a different colour or creed, the insolence of our usurpations, and the wild proselytizing of our priests, destroying the respect and goodwill that had initially been won by the superiority of our knowledge and the benefits of trade with us. But no doubt the moment is coming when we'll stop presenting ourselves to these people only as corruptors or tyrants, and will become for them sources of benefit or warm-hearted liberators. The sugar-growing industry that is now being established in Africa will put an end to the shameful robbery by which that enormous continent has been corrupted and depopulated through 2 centuries. Already in Great Britain, some friends of humanity have set the example. And if the force of public thinking has restrained that country's Machiavellian government from opposing it, what may we not expect from this same source when the reform of a servile and venal constitution leads to a government worthy of a humane and good-hearted people? Won't France be eager to imitate enterprises dictated equally by Europe's philanthropy and its true self-interest? Spice trading has already been introduced in the East, and we'll soon see the collapse of the spice monopoly that the Dutch have maintained by so much treachery, oppression, and crime. The nations of Europe will eventually learn that trading monopolies are merely a tax imposed on a nation's people to give their government a new instrument of tyranny. Then the Europeans, settling for free trade and too enlightened about their own rights to treat the rights of others lightly, will respect the independence that until now they have so insolently violated. Their settlements, instead of being filled by government hirelings who rush to exploit their position, or their privilege in committing robbery and treachery, to amass wealth with which to buy honours and titles back in Europe, will be staffed with hard-working men who will go to those pleasant climates in search of the comfortable way of life that they couldn't find in their native country. These men will be kept there in the colonies by liberty. Ambition will stop calling them back to Europe, and those counting houses of robbers will become colonies of citizens who will disseminate through Africa and Asia the principles and the example of Europe's liberty, enlightenment, and reason. Also, the monks who bring to these peoples nothing but shameful superstitions, and who antagonize folk by threatening them with a new tyranny, will be replaced by men who busy themselves spreading among these nations truths that serve their happiness and enlighten them about their interests as well as their rights. Zeal for the truth is one of the passions, and when it stops seeing itself surrounded by gross prejudices to be opposed and shameful errors to be dissipated, it will naturally extend its efforts to distant parts of the earth. These immense lands will present as candidates for the role of zealous truth-seekers numerous peoples that seem to need, in order to be civilized, only for us to give them the means for this, and for the Europeans to treat them as brothers, so as to have them as friends and disciples. Nations ground down by religious despots or stupid conquerors, having spent centuries calling for liberators. Nearly savage tribes, whose harsh climate has blocked them from having the gentle pleasures of a polished civilization, and deterred those who would have liked to help them in this from making the attempt. Or conquering tribes that know no law but force, and no profession but piracy. The advances of the third and fourth peoples will be slower and more tempestuous. It may even happen that, shrinking as they see themselves repelled by civilized nations, they will in the long run gradually disappear, or blend in with their neighbors. These events will be the inevitable consequence not only of Europe's advances, but of the freedom that the French and North American republics can, and in their own interests should, give to trade with Africa and Asia, that is, how they must necessarily result from the European nations' new-found wisdom, or from their obstinate adherence to mercantile prejudices. The only event that could block this revolution would be a new invasion of Asia by the Turks and Mongols, and this won't again be possible. Meanwhile, everything is working towards the early collapse of the great religions of the East. These have been abandoned to the people nearly everywhere, share the low moral level of their ministers, and in many regions are already regarded by those in power as mere political institutions. They no longer threaten to keep human reason in hopeless slavery and endless infancy. The progress of these peoples will be faster and steadier than ours has been, because they will get from us what we had to discover for ourselves, and because for them to know the simple truths and reliable methods that we arrived at only through many errors, all they'll need is to grasp their proofs and their developments in what we say and write. If the advances of the Greeks were lost on other nations, the blame for that lies with lack of communication between peoples and with a tyrannical domination of the Romans. But when mutual needs bring all men closer together, so that the most powerful nations are dedicated to equality among societies, as well as among individuals, to respect for the independence of weak states, as well as compassion for ignorance and wretchedness, when maxims that tighten the mainspring of the human faculties are replaced by ones that favour releasing it into action and energy, will it still be reasonable to fear that some parts of the globe are inaccessible to enlightenment, or that the pride of despotism will be able to go on for long, putting up insurmountable barriers to the truth? Second, inequality within individual nations. In surveying the history of societies, I'll have occasion to remark that there is often a big gap between the rights that the law grants to the citizens and the rights they really enjoy, between the equality that political institutions establish and the equality there is among individuals, and that this gap was a leading cause of the destruction of liberty in the ancient republics, the storms they endured, and the weakness that delivered them into the hands of foreign tyrants. These discrepancies have three principal causes: inequality of wealth, inequality of status between someone whose means of subsistence are secure for himself and will be inherited by his family, and someone whose resources depend on the length of his life, or rather of the part of his life in which he can work, and lastly, inequality of education. So it will have to be shown that these three kinds of real inequality must continually lessen, but without vanishing, for they have natural and necessary causes that it would be absurd and dangerous to try to destroy. Even trying to abolish their effects entirely would let loose more harmful sources of inequality, attacking the rights of man more directly and fatally. It is easy to prove that fortunes naturally tend to be equal, and that their extreme disproportion couldn't exist or couldn't last long if civil laws didn't introduce artificial means of perpetuating them and combining them, if complete freedom of commerce and industry abolished the advantages that every restrictive law gives to those who are already rich, if there weren't taxes on contracts, restrictions on the freedom to make them, tiresome formalities regarding them, uncertainty and expenses in having them enforced, all suppressing the poor man's activity and swallowing up his pitiful capital, if public administration didn't open to some men abundant sources of wealth that are closed to all the other citizens, if marriages weren't presided over by elderly people's spirit of greed and other prejudices, and if the simplicity of our manners and morals and the wisdom of our institutions stopped wealth from operating as the means of gratifying vanity or ambition, but didn't favour an ill-judged austerity that would forbid the use of wealth to pay for delicate pleasures, and thus lead to the hoarding of wealth. As for inequality of status, let us compare the present populations of the enlightened nations of Europe with the extent of their territories. As we look at their agriculture and industry, let us observe how labour and the means of subsistence are distributed. We'll see that it would be impossible to maintain these means at the same level, and thus to maintain the same size of population, if many individuals stopped having to depend, for almost the whole upkeep of themselves and their families, on their own work and the equipment they have bought to make the work possible, or to make it more productive. Now, these two resources depend on the family heads remaining alive, and indeed in good health. What he has is a sort of annuity, or something even more chancy than that, which creates a very real difference between this class of men and the class whose resources are not subject to the same risks, because their needs are met by income from land or by interest on capital that depends hardly at all on their work. So there's an inevitable cause of inequality, dependence, and even of misery, which ceaselessly threatens the most numerous and most active class of our societies. This inequality can be vastly reduced by setting chance against chance, securing for someone who grows old a support arising from his savings, but augmented by the savings of others who put their savings into a common fund, but died before they needed it, procuring, in a similar way, compensation for widows and fatherless children, with the costs and benefits not being affected by the man's age at death, and preparing for young folk who reach the age of working for themselves and starting their own family the benefit of the capital, for example, to buy equipment, that they need to get started on work. The idea of these procedures comes from the application of mathematics to the probabilities of life and investment of money. The procedures have already been employed with success, though never with the scope or the variety of forms that would make them truly beneficial to the whole mass of society, delivering them from that periodical ruin that afflicts so many families. There are other means of securing this equality, preventing credit from being a privilege so exclusively attached to large fortunes, yet providing an equally solid basis for it, making the advances in industry and the activity of commerce less dependent on the existence of great capitalists. These means also will be due to the application of mathematics. The educational equality that we can hope to attain, and that ought to be sufficient, is that which excludes all dependence, whether forced or voluntary. I'll show that in the present state of human knowledge, this is easily achievable, even by those who can devote only a few years of childhood to study, and will have only odd hours of leisure during their adult lives. I'll show that by a good choice of subjects to be taught, and methods of teaching them, the entire mass of a populace can be instructed in everything that each man needs to know for managing his household, administering his affairs, freely developing his work and his abilities, knowing what his rights are, and exercising and protecting them, knowing what his duties are, and being able to perform them well, judging his own actions and those of others by his own standards, not depending blindly on those to whom he is obliged to entrust the care of his interests or the exercise of his rights, being in a position to choose those people and then supervise them, so as no longer to be duped by the popular errors that torment a man's life with superstitious fears and flimsy hopes, defending himself against prejudices purely by the forces of his reason, and finally, escaping from the magic tricks of charlatanism that would set traps for his fortune, his health, his freedom of opinion, and of conscience, on the pretense of enriching, healing, and saving him. When that happens, the inhabitants of each country will no longer be distinguished from one another by the elegance or earthiness of their way of speaking, can be equally governed by their own understandings, will have knowledge of more than merely the mechanical processes of an art or the routine of a profession, and will no longer depend, in the most trifling affairs, or for the slightest information, on clever men whose skill puts them in charge. There inevitably will be such men. And then a real equality must result, because the difference of knowledge and talents can no longer place a barrier between men whose sentiments, ideas, and language allow them to understand one another. Some of them may want to be educated by others, but won't need to be led by them. Some may want to delegate to others, more enlightened, the responsibility for governing them, but they can't be forced to hand over this responsibility with blind confidence. That is when this superiority, the inevitable intellectual superiority of some men over others, will become an advantage even for those who don't have it, because it will exist for them and not against them. Natural difference of ability among men whose understandings haven't been cultivated produces, even among savages, charlatans and dupes, clever men and credulous ones, the same difference will doubtless exist among a people where education is truly general, and then it will be a difference between enlightened men and men with sound minds, who sense learning's value, but aren't dazzled by it, between talent or genius and the good sense that knows how to appreciate and enjoy these. The causes of equality I have listed don't act separately. They unite, meld together, support one another, and their combined influence is stronger, surer, and more constant. If education is more equal, that gives rise to more equality in work, and from that comes more equality in wealth. Equality in wealth must contribute to equality of education, and equality among peoples both helps and is helped by equality within a single people. In short, properly directed education corrects the natural inequality of abilities rather than increasing it, just as good laws remedy the natural inequality of the means of subsistence. And just as, in societies whose institutions bring about this equality, liberty, though regulated by law, will be more extensive than in the unregulated independence of savage life, then the social art will have achieved its goal, namely, securing and extending for everyone the enjoyment of the common rights they are called to by nature. Third, the perfecting of the human species. I have been showing that we can have almost sure hope of certain advances. The real advantages that must result from them can't be limited by anything except whatever limits there are to the perfecting of the human species. Why? Because in proportion as different kinds of equality equip the species with greater means for meeting our needs, with more universal education and more complete liberty, the more real this equality will be, the closer to taking in everything truly important to men's happiness. So the only way we can know how much we can hope for, what limits there are to the benefits we can come to enjoy, is by examining the course of this perfecting of the human species and the laws governing it. No one has ever thought that the human mind could grasp all the facts of nature, complete precision in measuring and analyzing those facts, all the ways in which objects are interrelated, and all the possible combinations of ideas. The mere relations of sizes, the combinations of this one idea of quantity or extent, form a system that is too immense for man's mind ever to grasp at all. However much of it he comes to penetrate, more than that will always remain unknown to him. But it has been found credible that we'll eventually come to a dead end, that man, being able ever to know only a part of the topics that the nature of his intelligence permits him to understand, must eventually reach a limit, where the number and complexity of the facts he already knows have absorbed all his powers, so that further progress will become absolutely impossible for him. But that is not clearly right, because as the range of known facts grows, men become correspondingly better at classifying them and reducing them to more general facts. At the same time, the instruments and methods for observing and measuring them exactly become more precise, as more and more relations are discovered among more and more objects. Men manage to reduce them to more general relations and express them in simpler language, presenting them in a way that enables more of them to be grasped without any increase in intellectual power or intellectual effort. As the mind comes to understand more complex constructs of ideas, simpler formulae will soon reduce their complexity. And the upshot of all this is that the truths that were hardest to discover, truths that at first couldn't even be understood except by deep thinkers, soon come to be expounded and proved by methods within the reach of average intelligences. And if the methods that led to new combinations come to be exhausted, if the use of them to deal with still unanswered questions demands from scientists more time or more intellectual power than they have, simpler and more general methods come to their aid and open up a new field to high intelligence. The energy and real scope of the human intellect will stay the same, but the instruments it can use will be multiplied and improved. These methods that will direct high intelligence in the discovery of new truths will increase equally the force and the speed of its operations. Applying these general reflections to the different sciences, I shall, in the full work of which this is a sketch, present for each science examples of this progressive improvement, examples that will leave no doubt that more improvements lie ahead. I shall make a special point of noting, with regard to sciences, that prejudice regards as nearest to their limit the possible advances that are the most probable and the nearest in time. I shall expound all the ways in which a more general and more philosophical application of the mathematical sciences to all branches of human knowledge are bound to increase the scope, precision, and unity of the system of that knowledge. I shall point out how our hopes would be greater if in each country education were more universal, giving to more people the elementary knowledge that might inspire them with a taste for a particular kind of study and the ability to make advances in it. How greatly these hopes would be further strengthened if more general affluence enabled more people to devote themselves to such study. Because at present, even in the most enlightened countries, barely 1 in 50 of those who have the natural talents gets the education needed to develop them. This educational equality, combined with the coming equality among different nations, will speed the sciences, whose advances depend on many observations in many places. All the benefit that this would bring to mineralogy, botany, zoology, and meteorology. In short, what a vast difference there is between the feeble means now available to these sciences and the means that man will then have at his disposal. If we pass now to the arts, whose theories depend on these same sciences, we'll see that their theoretical advances can march with those of the sciences, not having any other limits, that the procedures of the arts are capable of the same improvements as the methods of the sciences, that instruments, machines, and looms will go on adding to man's power and skill, increasing the excellence and precision of the things he makes, while reducing the amount of the time needed to produce them. When all that happens, this will be the end of the obstacles that still stand in the way of those advances, obstacles such as accidents that men will learn to foresee and prevent, and the unsanitariness of certain operations, work habits, and climates. In these advances in industry and well-being, leading to a better relation between what men need and what they can do, each successive generation will have, either from its own advances or from the products of previous generations, more usable goods than its predecessors. This will lead to an ever-rising level of health, and thus to an ever-growing population. So a certain line of questioning arises. Wouldn't a point be reached at which these necessary laws of improvement and increase came into conflict? Wouldn't the ever-increasing population eventually outrun the means of production, so that there would be, if not a continual loss of population and loss of well-being, then at least a sort of oscillation between good and bad? And wouldn't that be a perennial source of intermittent misery? Wouldn't this mark the limit beyond which no further improvement in the human condition would be possible? The point that the perfectibility of man would reach after ever so many centuries, but wouldn't ever be able to get past? Everyone can see that this point lies very far in the future, but aren't we bound to reach it some day? Well, if event E couldn't occur except at a time when the human species had acquired a level of knowledge and understanding that we today can hardly envisage, we today can't possibly know that E will occur, or that it won't. Who would be so bold as to guess now what developments there will some day be in the art of converting the elements of life to our use? And even if this limit were reached, it wouldn't lead to anything alarming for mankind's happiness or its indefinite perfectibility, if the following things are true. Before that time comes, reason will have advanced in step with the advances of the sciences and the arts, and the prejudices of superstition will have stopped infecting morality with a harshness that corrupts and degrades, instead of purifying and exalting it. Men will then know that if they have obligations regarding people not yet born, they will be obliged not to bring those beings into existence, but to ensure that they are happy if they come into existence, and will concern the general welfare of the human species, or the society in which the obliged person lives, or the family he belongs to, and not the puerile idea of cluttering the earth with beings who are useless and wretched. So there might be a limit to how many people the earth can support, and, thus, to how large the global population can be, without there being those early deaths from starvation that would be so contrary to nature, and to the social prosperity of some of the beings who have received life. The discovery, or rather the accurate analysis, of the basic principles of metaphysics, morals, and politics is still recent, and it was preceded by knowledge of very many truths of detail. So it is easy to think that those three disciplines have now reached their destination. The prejudice has arisen that nothing remains to be done in them, because there are no longer any gross errors to destroy or basic truths to establish. But it is easy to see how far we are from fully understanding the intellectual and moral faculties of man, how greatly knowledge of his duties, which requires knowledge of how his actions will affect the welfare of his fellow creatures and of his society, can be increased by a steadier, deeper, and more accurate observation of that action to upshot relation. How many questions still have to be answered, how many social ties have to be examined, before we can have precise knowledge of the individual rights of man and of the rights that the social state confers on the whole community with regard to each member? Have we yet even set with any precision the limits of these rights, whether between different societies or of single societies over their members in times of trouble and division, or of individuals and of free associations at the time of their first formation, or of their having to be dissolved. If we pass now to the theory that will have to direct the application of these principles, serving as the basis of the social art, don't we see the need for a level of precision that these absolutely general first truths aren't capable of? Have we reached the point where we can base our laws on either justice or proved and acknowledged utility, rather than on vague, uncertain, and arbitrary views of claimed political advantages? Have we settled on precise rules to guide a confident choice among the almost infinite variety of possible systems that would respect the general principles of equality and natural rights, the ones that best secure the preservation of these rights, give the widest scope for their exercise and enjoyment, and best promote the leisure and welfare of individuals, and the strength, peace, and prosperity of nations? The application of the calculus of combinations and probabilities to these same sciences of metaphysics, morals, and politics promises advances that will get added importance from the fact that this calculus is the only means of giving their results an almost mathematical precision, and of judging how certain or probable they are. The facts that support these results may well lead, at a glance, without calculation, to some general truths, telling us whether the effects produced by such and such a cause are good or bad. But if these facts can't be counted or weighed, if these effects can't be subjected to exact measurement, we shan't be able to know how much good or bad the cause in question produces. And if the good and bad are nearly equal, the difference between them being small, we won't even be able to say confidently which way the balance swings. Without the application of this calculus, it would often be impossible to make a secure choice between two routes to a single goal, when there was no obvious difference between their respective advantages. Without this mathematical help, these sciences would remain forever crude and limited, because of their lack of machines sound enough to get down into the depths of the mine, where some of the wealth of these sciences lies hidden. Yet this application, despite the happy efforts of certain geometers, is still in a rudimentary state, so to speak, and to future generations it must open a source of knowledge that is, like the calculating science itself, and like the combinations of relations and facts that it can be applied to, truly inexhaustible. When men become enlightened about the nature and development of their moral sentiments, the principles of morality, the natural motives that prompt them to act morally, and their interests as individuals or as members of society, they will inevitably make advances in moral practice that are as real as those they make in the theory of morality. Isn't a mistake about our interests the most frequent cause of actions contrary to the general welfare? Isn't the violence of our passions often the effect of habits that we have acquired only through false calculations, or of our not knowing how to resist the passions at their outset, so as to tame them, steer them, direct their action? Isn't the practice of reflecting on one's own conduct, listening to the deliverances of reason and conscience upon it, and having gentle feelings that don't distinguish one's own happiness from that of others, isn't all this an inevitable result of the well-directed study of morality, and of greater equality in the conditions of the social compact? There are hosts of reasons, which I'll develop at length in the work itself, to think that man's moral goodness, the necessary consequence of his constitution, is, like all his other faculties, capable of indefinite improvement, and that nature binds together truth, happiness, and virtue by a chain that can't be broken. Among the advances of the human mind that matter most to general happiness, we must include the total annihilation of the prejudices that have established an inequality of rights between the sexes, an inequality that is deadly even to the sex that it favours. It would be useless to try to justify it by differences of physical organisation, of intellect, or of moral sensibility, this inequality began as a pure abuse of strength, and subsequent attempts to excuse it by bad arguments have all been wasted breath. I shall show how much the abolition of the practices authorised by this prejudice, and of the laws that it has dictated, can do to increase the happiness of families, and spread the virtues of domestic life, which are the basis of all the other virtues, and to favour advances in education, above all, making it truly general, because it would be extended more equally to both sexes, and because it can't become general even for men without the support of the mothers of families. This long overdue tribute to equity and good sense will dry up a brimming well of injustices, cruelties, and crimes by abolishing the dangerous opposition between man's most vigorous and hard to control natural propensity and his duties or the interests of society. Wouldn't it at last produce something that until now has been merely a pipe dream? I mean, mild and pure national manners and morals, not formed by proud asceticism, hypocritical appearances of sexual propriety, or sexual moderation imposed by the fear of shame or religious terrors, but by habits freely contracted, inspired by nature, and acknowledged by reason. When people are more enlightened, and have reclaimed the right to dispose of their own blood and their own goods, they'll gradually come to regard war as the deadliest scourge, the worst of all crimes. The first wars to disappear will be the ones that usurpers of national sovereignty drag their subjects into defence of supposed hereditary rights. Nations will know that they can't become conquerors without losing their freedom, that permanent confederations are the only way to maintain their independence, that they should aim for security, not power. Commercial prejudices will gradually die away. False ideas about mercantile interest will lose their terrible power of drenching the earth in blood, ruining nations on the pretence of enriching them. As the nations come closer to one another in their views on the principles of politics and morality, and as each of them, for its own advantage, invites foreigners to have a more equal share in the benefits that nature or industry have given it, all the causes that produce, intensify, and perpetuate national hatreds will gradually disappear. They'll no longer provide either fuel or pretext for the fury of war. The advances of this brotherhood of nations will be accelerated by institutions that are better conceived than the projects of perpetual peace with which certain philosophers have filled their spare time and soothed their souls, and wars between nations will count, like assassinations, as extraordinary atrocities, humiliating and loathsome in the eyes of nature, and fixing an indelible stain on the country or the age whose history records them. Regarding the fine arts in Greece, Italy, and France, I said that one should distinguish in their productions what really belongs to the progress of the art from what is due only to the talent of the artist. Now I shall turn from the past to the future, and consider what advances in the fine arts may still be expected. Whether because of advances in philosophy and the sciences, more observations or deeper ones concerning the goal, the effects, and the means of the fine arts themselves, or the abolition of the prejudices that have narrowed their sphere and still hold them back by the yoke of authority from which the sciences and philosophy have broken free. I'll look into something that has been believed, namely, the means of the fine arts are bound to dry up because the most sublime beauties, or the most touching ones, have been taken, the happiest subjects have been treated, the simplest and most striking ideas have been used, the most prominent and general characters have been portrayed, the liveliest passions and their truest or most natural expressions, the most striking truths and the most brilliant images have been put to work by the artists, so that the fine arts, whatever growth we attribute to their means, are condemned to an eternal and monotonous imitation of their first models. I shall show that this opinion is nothing but a prejudice born of the habit of artists and literary folk of judging the men rather than enjoying their works. The thoughtful pleasure that comes from comparing the products of different ages and countries, and from being amazed by the efforts or the success of genius, may be lost. But the pleasure to be derived from the productions themselves, because of their own real perfection, needn't be less lively, even in cases where the artist doesn't deserve as much credit for rising to that level of perfection. As there come to be more works that are really worth preserving, and as they become more perfect, each generation will direct its attention and admiration to those that deserve to be singled out, and the rest will gradually be forgotten, and the pleasures to be derived from the simpler and more striking beauties that were first seized on will still be had by our posterity, even though those beauties are found only in more modern works. The advances of the sciences guarantee advances in the art of education, which then speed up those of the sciences, and this reciprocal influence, whose action is ceaselessly renewed, must count as one of the most active and powerful causes of the perfecting of the human race. A young man, graduating from one of our universities today, knows more in mathematics than Newton learned by profound study, or discovered by the force of his genius. He can handle the instrument of calculation with an ease that was unknown back then. The same observation applies, though not quite equally, to all the sciences. The more a given science grows, the better it becomes at compressing more demonstrations of truths within less space, making them easier to understand. Thus, not only will this be the case for each generation, despite the new advances in the sciences, men of equally high intelligence will, at the same stage of their individual lives, come to be right on top of the present state of the science they are working on. But so also will this. The amount that can be learned in a given stretch of time by the same strength of intellect and the same level of attention will inevitably increase, and the elementary part of each science, the part that everyone can master, will grow, coming ever closer to containing all the knowledge that everyone needs if he is to steer himself through everyday life and freely exercise his reason. In the political sciences, there's a category of truths which, particularly in free countries, and so eventually in all countries, can't be useful until they are generally known and accepted. So the influence of these sciences on the freedom and prosperity of nations must be somewhat measured by how many of those truths are lodged in everyone's mind through elementary education. So the growing advances in elementary education, tied to the inevitable advances in these sciences, provides us with the guarantee of an improvement in the lot of the human race that can be regarded as indefinite, because it could only be limited by limits on those two kinds of advance. I have to address two other general means that are bound to influence improvements in both the art of education and the sciences. One is a broader and better use of what may be called technical methods. The other is the setting up of a universal language. By technical methods, I mean the art of bringing many objects into a systematic layout that lets one see at a glance their interrelations, quickly grasp the complexes that they form, and more easily form new complexes from them. In the full work, I shall expound the principles of this art, and bring out how useful it can be. Today it is still in its infancy, but when it is perfected, it can offer us the advantage of presenting within the narrow compass of a chart material that it would often be hard to make so quickly or so well understood in a big book. And something even more valuable, a way to present isolated facts in the layout that is best for deriving general results from them. It's easy to learn how to use these charts, and I'll show how, with the help of a few of them, men who have been stuck at the level of elementary education, and thus haven't been able to absorb, to make their own, knowledge of details that are useful in everyday life, will come to be able to lay their hand on those details as needed, and how these technical methods can make elementary education easier in all the branches of it that are concerned with either a regular system of truths or a series of observations and facts. A language is universal if it expresses by signs either real objects or well-defined collections of simple and general ideas that all men can form in their understandings, or the general relations among these ideas. Anyone who knew these signs, the ways to combine them, and the rules for forming them, would understand what is written in this language, and could easily translate it into the vernacular of his own country. Clearly this language could be used to expound either the theory of a science or the rules of an art, to report a new experiment or observation, the invention of a procedure, the discovery of a truth or of a method, and, as in algebra, when new signs have to be introduced, they will be explainable in terms of the already existing ones. Such a language doesn't have the drawback of a scientific idiom different from the vernacular. I have remarked that the use of such an idiom necessarily divides societies into two unequal classes, one composed of men who understand the language and thus have the key to the sciences, the other of those who have been unable to learn it and so are almost completely unable to acquire knowledge. The universal language that I am describing, on the other hand, would be learned, as the language of algebra is, along with learning the science itself. The sign would be known at the same time as the object, idea or operation that it stands for. Anyone who had learned the elements of a science and wanted to go further in it would find in books not only truths he could understand with the aid of the signs whose meanings he already knew, but the explanation of further signs that were needed for him to go on to other truths. I'll show that the formation of such a language, if confined to the expressing of simple and precise propositions, like those that form the system of a science or the practice of an art, is far from being a mere fantasy, that even today it could easily be set up for many topics, and that the chief obstacle to its being extended to others would be the embarrassing smallness of our stock of precise ideas, accurately defined notions, understood exactly in the same sense by every mind. I'll show how this language, with daily improvements and enlargements of its scope, would bring to every topic that comes within the reach of human intelligence a rigor and precision that would make it easy to know the truth and almost impossible to go wrong. Then each science would go forward as securely as mathematics does, and the propositions constituting its system would have all the certainty of geometry, that is, everything permitted by the propositions, subject matter, and method. All these causes of the improvement of the human species must always exert active influence, and continually broaden their scope. I have presented the evidence for this, and when it is developed at length in the work itself, it will be even stronger. So we can already conclude that man is indefinitely improvable, and we have reached this point while assuming him to go on having only the same natural faculties that he has now, as being internally organized in the same way. Think how sure we could be about man's future improvement, how much we might hope for on his behalf, if we believed that these natural faculties themselves, this organization, could also be improved. This is the last matter that I have to examine. The organic perfectibility or deterioration of the species of plants and animals can be regarded as one of the general laws of nature. This law extends to the human race. And surely no one will doubt that advances in remedial medicine, healthier food and housing, a lifestyle that develops physical powers by exercise without ruining them by excess, and lastly eliminating degradation's two most active causes, extreme poverty, and extreme wealth, are bound to prolong man's average lifespan, and secure for him better health and a sturdier constitution. We can sense that advances in preventive medicine, which will become more efficacious because of advances in reason and the social order, are bound eventually to put an end to hereditary and contagious illnesses and to general ill health arising from climate, food, and working conditions. It wouldn't be hard to show that this hope should apply to almost every other illness whose remote causes we come to discover. Would it be absurd now to suppose that this improvement is capable of indefinite progress? To suppose that the time must come when death will be due only to extraordinary accidents, or to the decay, slower and slower down through the generations, of the person's vital forces, and that eventually the amount of time between a person's birth and this decay will have no assignable value? Certainly man won't become immortal, but can't the interval between a man's birth and his death become ever longer? Since I am now speaking of a progress that can be precisely represented by numbers or on a graph, this is the place where I should explain the two meanings that the word indefinite can have. This average lifespan that we are supposing to keep lengthening as men push on into the future could be growing in either of two ways. One is by following a law, such that the lifespan continually approaches some determinate length without being able to reach it, like the series n minus 1/2, n minus 1/4, n minus 1/8, n minus 1/16, and so on. The other is by following a law, such that as the centuries unroll, the lifespan becomes longer than any determinate quantity that might have been assigned as its limit, like the series 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. In the second case, the increases are really indefinite, in the strictest sense of the word, since there is no length x, such that the lifespan must be shorter than x. In the first case, the increases are also indefinite in the sense of being indefinite to us, because we can't say what the length n is that the lifespan can go on approaching but can never reach. The fact is that even if we know that the increases can never stop, we don't know whether they are indefinite in the first sense or in the second. And this is the end point of our present knowledge of the perfectibility of the human species, the sense in which we can call human perfectibility indefinite. Thus, in the example we are considering, we have to believe that average human lifespan will increase for ever, unless physical upheavals prevent this. But we don't know what the length is that it can't ever exceed. We don't even know whether the laws of nature have set any such limit. But that doesn't end the questions about human perfectibility. Mightn't it be that individual improvements in the strength, dexterity, and acuteness of our senses can be transmitted from one generation to the next? Observation of the various breeds of domestic animals should incline us to think so, and we can confirm this by direct observation of the human species. Lastly, can we hope for the same thing for our intellectual and moral faculties? Mightn't it be that our parents, who transmit to us the benefits or defects of their bodily constitution, and from whom we receive our distinctive facial features, as well as our tendency to certain physical upsets, also transmit to us that part of the physical organization that determines intelligence, brain power, energy of soul, or moral sensibility? Isn't it likely that education, by improving these qualities, also influences, modifies, and improves this physical organization? These questions bring to an end my examination of this last era, and this picture of the human species, freed from all its shackles, no longer dominated by chance or by the enemies of its advances, and striding with a firm and sure step along the path of truth, virtue, and happiness, how consoling it is for the philosopher who laments the errors, the crimes, and the injustices which still pollute the earth, and of which he is often a victim. Contemplating this picture is the reward for all his efforts on behalf of reason's advances and the defence of liberty. He ventures to regard these efforts as links in the eternal chain of human destiny, and that is the true repayment for virtue, namely the pleasure of having done lasting good that fate can't destroy through any operation that brings back prejudice and slavery. This contemplation is for him a refuge into which the memory of his persecutors cannot pursue him. In there, he unites himself in thought with man, re-established in his rights and in the dignity of his nature. He forgets those who are tormented and corrupted by greed, fear, or envy. He truly lives there with people like him, in an Elysium which his reason has created for him, and which his love for humanity enhances with the purest joys. End of Era 10. End of the work.